Give me a mic check for Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa, Florida.
Oh, hello, check one Tampa, check two Tampa. I need some more on one.
Okay.
Casino, check, check. Hard Rock, Tampa, check, check. Seminole Hard Rock.
Check it out for yourself at SeminoleHardRock.com. All right, guys, I'm rolling. Let's kick it.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock here in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening. Please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. Joining me today is Uli Bea, a saxophone player in the long-running Los Angeles-based band Ozomatli. They're known for their unique blend of rock, Latin, reggae, R&B, and hip-hop influences. This summer, we've been featuring several of their tracks off their 2010 album Fire Away. We'll hear some of one of them right now, Yeah, 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 Yeah. And then I'll be back on the line with Uli Bea for your Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. Here in Little Stephen's Underground Garage, and it's time for our coolest conversations. Joining me today is Ulises Bea from the LA band Ozomatli. They feature a mixture of rock along with salsa, jazz, funk, reggae, hip hop, and come up with their own very unique sound. Hi, Uli, how are you?
Good. How are you doing? How's everything? Thank you so much for the interview. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thanks for joining me. Now, you play primarily saxophone in the band, or what else do you play?
Mostly a sax guy, but I play clarinet. I play also requinto, which is an instrument from Veracruz, Mexico. I play melodica, keys. Sometimes I'll play a little guitar, depends on the song. Yeah, I'm kind of the multi-guy, because, you know, not every song needs a horn line, and not every song needs a big, you know. So I've been able to adapt to that, and whatever the composition requires, that's what I usually try to work something out to figure, what am I going to do on this song, you know?
Well, can you tell us something about your background? Like, are you from the Los Angeles area? Where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in Hollywood. My parents then, we were probably lived out there, that kind of area, Hollywood, Silver Lake area, for like about, I think, 5 years or something like that. And then we ended up moving out to the Southeast, you know, because that was the whole thing, you know. It was like, especially for my parents being immigrants, you know, it was like always about owning a house or whatever, like, you know, establishing, you know, their dream. And so we moved out here to Bell. This whole little area, Southeast LA, Bell Gardens, Maywood, was all pretty much in, you know, industrial cities. You know, they were all kind of like, it kind of happened similar to what happened in Detroit, where once the, you know, jobs left, people left, you know, and there was a lot of industry going on in here. But then, this is where I've been, this is where I was raised, you know. And through my life, though, the thing that happened that I think kind of really kind of set the whole kind of my, I guess, my trajectory to knowing the rest of the city and getting to know what LA is about was in my transition from fifth to sixth grade. There was this middle school that had like a terrible reputation around here, right? And all my friends that were hoods, the fucking hooligans, were all going to this school, you know, all of like the bad kids that I hung out with. And my mom, in her wisdom, she was just like, at the time, she's like, you know what? I know you like music. I know, you know, this. So I'm going to there was a program called the Magnet Program here in LA, where they would bus kids to different schools. So I ended up getting bused from sixth grade all the way to ninth grade. And then I went to the high school for the arts. And all this experience really just opened up every single neighborhood of LA to me, you know, because here's my bus going through, you know, my area into South Central, into Koreatown, all the way into, you know, Miracle Mile area. My high school was people from all over LA. So I was able to kind of see different, not only cultures, but socioeconomic, you know, like between the families and all this other stuff. So it was really kind of like helpful for me to grow up in that environment, you know, just seeing LA as a whole, you know?
Well, you mentioned your mom, in her wisdom, recognizing that you had an interest in music. So how was that represented at the time? I mean, were you actually playing any instruments?
Yeah.
Or what?
Well, my dad played classical violin, actually. And my mom is from Mexico and my dad's from Spain. So each of them brought their, I guess, you know, musical taste to the table. So my dad was very much into, obviously, Spanish music from Spain, whether flamenco or whatever pop stuff was coming out of there. And also classical music. Classical music was a big thing for him. And my mom, well, she just loved music. And she loved, obviously, the music from Mexico, all the stuff that she listened to. But she was also super into, you know, the Beatles, the Beach Boys, you know, all that stuff. So it really, I mean, I had a record collection at a very early age. And I started on piano lessons at a very early age, even though I really wanted to learn electric guitar. I really did. But Pops was like, no, you should take piano. It'll be the best, like, foundation for your whole musical knowledge. And at that time, I didn't really appreciate that. I was just like, nah, this is lame. I want to learn electric guitar. But he was completely right. And you know, and so I took classical lessons, piano lessons for years. And then I jumped onto clarinet, which is usually the, you know, the school band thing. And from there, a little bit after middle school, a little bit into middle school, I picked up the sax because it was the kind of the natural progression. Yeah. And from there, I started picking up other things. I didn't bring back the electric guitar into my thing until like maybe ninth grade, where I was like, I'm going to learn electric guitar too. And at that point, I was starting to get into punk rock music, garage music, all this other type of stuff. And it's interesting because I wanted to keep the guitar informal. So I didn't want to take lessons on guitar. I wanted to just learn Ramon songs. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's pretty funny that at the end of the, you know, when it all kind of came full circle a little bit, you know?
So you guys have been active since like 1995, 27 something years. Were you tight with any of the band members before it formed, or what got you guys together?
Well, interesting. Interestingly enough, like Justin, our percussionist rapper in the band, I've known him since middle school. He's one of the guys I actually met because I was bused. And I met him and his brother. His father was a really famous session musician, Greg Perret, here in Los Angeles, played with countless of acts and you name it. And his family comes from a musical background too. I don't know if you remember that song, Just Keep On Trucking, Baby. I don't know if you remember that song, but like his family wrote that song. I was like, whoa. But also some of the other guys I've kind of met through just different circles of musicians, you know, growing up, like Will Dog would show up to my high school to jam with people. I remember seeing him and being like, who's this guy? And the whole thing was at that point, since my high school had a reputation of really good musicians, da, 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 other kids would come down and just to look for jams, you know? But through all that, the main catalyst that kind of started all of Ozo Motley was basically this, like, Will Dog, our bass player, and our original drummer, Anton Morales, were part of this California Conservation Corps program, post-riots LA, they were, you know, given these jobs to like paint over graffiti, plant trees, do these things. But they were actually involved in this whole thing where they would do these plays for earthquake preparedness at elementary schools and things like that. Now, the thing is that these workers, there's about 30 of them, they started to think about like, hey, why don't we unionize? Why don't we like get together and do this thing? And in that process of even contemplating unionization, they all got fired. And it created this real big, like, you know, like obviously like conflict between the kids, the LA Conservation Corps. And then once the media was involved, it was like this, you know, a little bit of a shitstorm. So they ended up keeping the rights to the building through a mediation process. They ended up keeping the rights to the building that they were working in, which was in downtown LA, 4th and Bixel. Mm-hmm. And they renamed this place called the Peace and Justice Center. Now, in this place, they basically decided to do this like almost like a community center, but
yeah,
but almost on a punk rock style, almost like where there was like, you know, skateboarding, breakdancing. There was a poetry reading. There was band rehearsals. There were people who were squatting there. There was all kinds of things going on there. So there was a real cool energy going on there. So what ended up happening is that Will Dog, like when they would do these parties every weekend to help raise funds for the operating cost of the center, Will Dog called me and other people called each other and were like, hey man, you want to come and jam for this Peace and Justice Center? You know, it's like cool cause. Okay, yeah, sounds good. So people that ended up showing up to these jams are the people that ended up being the foundation for Ozo Motley. And that was kind of like how we all kind of like ended up being in this one place at this one time.
Very cool. No, I didn't know that. Yeah. Back think in 1998, that's when you released a self-titled debut album. Three more followed. And then in 2010, you came out with Fire Away, and that's caught that caught Little Steven's ear recently. And we've been playing several tracks off the album this summer. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been some time since that that album came out. Any, do you have any reflections on it, like thinking back about the album, how it turned out, anything that you would like to have changed?
We worked with Tony Berg on that album.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about him too, but yeah, tell me about it.
Super cool. We actually recorded it in his home studio. He lived in Brentwood. And if you know LA, from where I'm at to Brentwood is like, oh my God, you're driving there every day, man. Yes, I was. So the process was cool, you know. The only kind of crappy memory I have of it was like when during the mixing, there was a lot of back and forth. And then it was always that one thing where it's like, I think it sounded better like three mixes ago, man, you know, but you know, that's neither here nor there at this point. That's just like junk that like musicians, you know, whine about and think about and keeps them up at night. But yeah. You know, the other thing that was kind of interesting about that was post a lot of our cultural ambassador trips that we had done, you know. So we had as a cultural ambassadors, we were hitting up places and countries that most bands never go to. So we were like going to places like Madagascar. We went to Burma, Myanmar. We went to.
Did you play someplace in Mongolia or something?
Yeah, Mongolia. We were in Mongolia, Ulaanbaatar. One of the songs on that album, I'm pretty sure there's a song called Malagasy Shock on that album. Now, that whole song is based on when we went to play in Madagascar. We were at the, you know, we were going to play this huge, because usually with the cultural ambassador thing, it's like you'd always do like, outreach stuff, like go to like an orphanage, or you would go to like a music school, or you would, you know, go somewhere to go play for people. And then you would you would culminate it with a big free show for everybody. So on that particular day, it was going to be in the park, this huge park in the middle of their capital. And it was going to be the vibe was already like, you could tell, like right when we were about to start, like it was going to be a great show. Like, oh my God, like everyone's already reacting. We're into the set. a song, my friend. And I see our guitarist Raul just start jumping up and down, like really going off. And at first, my initial reaction was like, damn, Raul is really getting into it. He's really punking out. He's like going off, this guy. What I didn't realize is that they hadn't grounded the stage properly. So the microphone actually got stuck to his chest, and obviously he has the guitar, so he closed that loop and he was getting electrocuted. I realized there was something wrong right when he jumped into the timbales, the whole percussion section, and smashed everything. And somehow from that, he broke the connection and was on the floor. And we were like, what the hell happened? And he was really close to losing his life, you know, and we had to monitor him like 24 hours after, because after you electrocute yourself that hard, it creates a too much lactic acids in your body. It's like every single muscle in your body has constricted that way. Yeah. So from that experience, we wrote Malagasy Shock. So, which is, you know, it's kind of, that's the one song I always remember from Far Away, just because it had such a crazy, story attached to it, you know?
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, I was getting tense there with when you were talking about him being shocked like that. Before we started chatting, we were taking a listen to Yeah off of Fire Away. And several songs of the album have got a bit of kind of a 60s East Side Soul flavor to them. Elysian Persuasion even name checks Little Willie G. Mm-hmm. He sang with the Midnighters. Mm-hmm. On Yeah, there's a cool kind of boogaloo-like riff. Do you recall how that song came together?
Yes, and this particular one does have it's kind of a bittersweet one a little bit, just because.
Yeah.
So that's a cover. That's a cover song from the Pogues. I don't know if you remember the Pogues.
I do remember the Pogues, the Rum, Sodomy, and the Lash.
Yes. And I've always loved the Pogues. Pogues are cool. Now, the thing is that the label we were on kept insisting on us doing this song, you know, and we were like, okay, you know, like maybe we'll think about it. Cause we, at that point, you know, Ozomali's never been that much of a covers band. You know, we don't really do that many covers, but they kept insisting. And we're like, okay, what's the deal? Well, we ended up finding out that they had owned the rights to that song and they just wanted another band to redo it. They insisted to the point where it was like one of those things. They kind of put their foot down and said, come on, guys, you guys got to do this song. So we ended up just doing it. And we ended up kind of giving it a little bit, like you mentioned, like a little bit of a boogaloo flavor and a little bit of this and that to kind of make it our own. And that's how was started.
Very cool. Well, Elysian Persuasion, another track we've been highlighting this summer. Mm-hmm. You're talking about Elysian Park, where Dodger Stadium is?
Yep.
So some good times there still?
For sure. And you know, you kind of hit the nail on the head as far as like some of the influences at that point with a song like Elysian Persuasion and also like a song like Devatos in Love, where we're definitely mining and pulling from the Chicano soul scene from the 60s and the 70s, you know? Your Malos, your Tierras, your Midnighters. And there was tons of other bands that are not as famous, but they were all kind of in that scene, you know. That one in particular, that one actually started off a riff that I was playing on guitar. And Tony really kind of dug it. And we just started building it and building it and building it. And then we just kind of created this setting, this story of Elysian Park, you know, because Asdrew actually grew up in your areas and in that whole area, Cypress Park, Highland Park, Mount Washington. Mm-hmm. And they Elysian Park was always one of those places where a lot of people would gravitate to day and night, you know what I mean, for different activities, you know.
Well, Gay Vatos and Love, that got almost a doo-wop, definitely a 50s vibe to it. Which came first, the lyric idea or the music?
I want to say the music came first, if I remember correctly. Now, you know, this is a long time ago, but this I remember the music kind of, usually the music comes first with Ozo. And then at that point, there had been a lot of controversy concerning LGBTQ rights and all this other stuff. And that's just kind of our, that's kind of our a stand on it in a certain way, you know, like we all know people growing up in the neighborhood or have family that were LGBTQ or whatever. And we just felt it like kind of like, hey man, let's make a love song about this kind of, you know, and we flipped it. And each verse in that song kind of references, like, you know, like there's one, I think one verse in there that talks about Club Cobra, which was a really, really, really famous gay bar in North Hollywood, and all these other things. And interestingly, like, you know, in the time where we were playing that song live, it brought a whole different kind of angle to Ozo, kind of like, whoa, like people were coming up to me like, oh my God, that song, you know, thank you guys. And da, 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 you know, it's like, whoa, you know, this is just kind of like our way to like lend support in a lot of ways to how much their rights at the time were getting encroached on. So, yeah.
So, I mean, you guys, when you, in fact, you're talking about the band's formation, I mean, you've always had this social and kind of political consciousness to what you're doing. In fact, I found a quote, and I think this was you, interviewed around the time of when that the album came out. You said, the connection of all our struggles together, whether it's the women's movement, the African-American movement, the Chicano movement, the Asian movement, you name it, our struggles are very much connected. And it's that point of seeing the connection that I think is very important for us to bring to light. So this was back in about 2010. It's a lot of stuff has gone on since then, obviously. Mm-hmm. Is it more important to shine that light now than ever before? Or what do you think?
Oh, I mean, issues and things that are important to us are always constantly changing. Some things are always the same, you know, but Ozo Motley has always lended itself to, like, ever since the beginning, like in those days, and I was mentioning to you before, like the peace and justice days, there was a moment where it's like, it felt like Ozo Motley was the house band for every cause that needed music at their demonstration or at their rallies. Like, we were just always working, and we were always kind of like, hey, do you want to play for this immigrants' rights march? Yeah, sure, we'll do it. You know, do you want to do this thing for, like, this women's shelter? Yeah, sounds good. You know, whatever. So it's kind of almost part of our DNA at this point. Like, that, I guess that's the one cool thing about Ozo Motley, is that, like, we never were kind of Johnny-come-lately to that whole aspect of being, you know, activism in music, you know what I mean? Like, it was always kind of like, well, yeah, of course, yeah. You know, if I can lend my presence and my music to this cause that I think is important, like, why not, you know? So, yeah, it's always kind of been a part of us. And, you know, like, again, like I mentioned, you know, like, causes have changed through the years, and what we considered important, you know, like, there'll be times, or even when we're on the road and people come up to us and present us like local things that we might be interested in trying to support, you know? And so it's kind of been that way since the beginning of the band. It's always been kind of important. It doesn't define us completely, but it's always been very, very important.
Well, now, you had a new album that came out last month, right? In July, Marching On.
Mm-hmm. July 15th, we just came out with a new record called Marching On. And we were actually in the middle of recording it in Sonic Ranch near El Paso, right at the beginning of the pandemic. So, you know, here we are in the studio trying to finish this record, and all these things are happening. And for most of us, we were just kind of all thinking like, oh, this is just going to be like SARS part two. Like, this is going to be like another swine flu. It's going to go away in a month. Little did we, you know, I think little did all of us know that, you know, that, right. you know, that it was going to go down like this. So there was this, you know, thing when after we left that studio, there were still parts to record. There were still things. So we basically completed the whole album at home studios at different places. And then there was a whole debate about, do we just release the record? Because, you know, some artists, some bands, they released music during the pandemic. Yeah. But for us, it was like one of those things that it's like our bread and butter is the live show. You know what I mean? So
it
was kind of hard to fathom releasing music and not being able to tour on it, you know? So it was just really important for us to like hold off as much as we could. And then at that point, it ended up working out because we had already, the record was already finished when we were shopping it to label, you know, it was already like done for the most part, musically speaking. Sure, the artwork and that, all that stuff hadn't been done, but so it was really cool to find this label, Blue Elan, that was willing to go in it with us and release this record. So yeah, Marching On, it just came out July 15th. So far so good. The fans have been reacting pretty good to the new music, because that's the other thing, you know, usually when you release something new, you're going to see if whether or not your old crew digs it, you know, and even though it is sometimes you're trying to evolve your sound too, but then you're also trying to keep that rawness from the beginning that made people love you.
Well, you mentioned, you guys drawing a lot of your income from touring, from performing, and you're very highly regarded as a really terrific live band. You got the new album out. How much touring do you have in store over the next couple of months?
We got some, you know, we were just in Colorado not too long ago. And next month, we got a bunch of gigs lined up. And one of the funner ones is actually it's the Latin Legends tour. But it's not a tour. It's a cruise, my man. And we're going to be on the same boat as Los Lobos, as Tower of Power, as War. So, you know, all these bands were, you know, immensely influential to us. You know, we're going to be on the boat with and hanging out, you know.
Hey, so wait a minute. So Marching On has got a track on there. Is it Mula? M-U-L-A?
Yes.
That's got kind of that had me ready to spill the wine right there. I was ready to spill the wine. So
that you that's funny you say that. That one, that track, Mula, was funny because the initial idea of that song started with Azu. He had been writing for that TV show, The Mayans, you know, that spinoff of Sons of Anarchy.
Okay.
And he brought it to the studio with that chorus, I believe. And then our producer, David, was like, let's go a totally different direction than what we're used to. So he recruited me to like break out my best Chicano Tom Waits impression. You know, like do like a spoken word, but like a story, man. I'm like, okay, well, and part of it too is that this studio is really close to the border. So we're constantly hearing crazy stories about narcos and trafficking and this and this and that.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I just use that as fodder for my story. Like I just came up with this thing about how this guy is calling this woman about this job, basically. A mula is a mule. So it's like basically I'm recruiting this drug mule and I'm telling her the all the details and what she needs to do and this and this and that. And yeah, it's funny how that particular track so far is gaining kind of attraction because it's something that we've never done. Like a spoken wordish kind of like arty song like that, you know?
Yeah. Very cool. Oh, you know, when you were talking about playing in Madagascar, that whole story, and I was going to ask you, and I got thrown off because, you know, because it was so shocking, so to speak.
Yeah, right, right.
But it had to do with being able to play all over the world as cultural ambassadors. Did I get that right?
Mm-hmm.
How were you able to do that? How did you wind up doing that?
The cultural ambassador gig?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that one's interesting too, because at the time it was the Bush administration, the second one. And the band had already been involved in a lot of like anti-war protests and things like that. So we got this phone call. I guess somebody in the State Department that deals with that type of stuff heard an interview of ours on NPR, and I don't know if she just instantly fell in love with us or just was like really interested in us. And she hit up our management and was like, hey, would you think these guys would be like cultural ambassadors or be willing to go play? And at first we were like, are you guys even sure? Do you guys even know who we are and what we've stood for in the past? You know, it's like, and they're like, yeah. And then that already made me like, what is going on? Because, you know, it obviously stirred a huge debate in the band about, you know, whether or not we should do it, you know? And our first trip was actually India and Nepal. We played in Kathmandu. And from that first trip, we already knew that it was going to be a good thing for us because number one, it was our way of establishing like a connection with places that no bands ever went to. Like, I don't think any I'm not sure if this is true or not, but they kept saying to us that we were the first American band to ever play Kathmandu. I'm like, really? I find that hard to believe, but they kept telling us that. So in that, like just to use Kathmandu as an example, you know, we realized when we land there, like there's maybe 10 people in the whole country who know who the hell we are. You know what I mean? But they advertise that this American band is going to play for free, you know? And like over 10,000 people ended up showing up to this show. And it was wild because at that point, it's really all about, do the people like your music? Because they don't know you. They don't know your hype. They don't know what you've done, you know? Right. It's all based on the music. Do you like the music or you don't, you know? And the funny thing is that when we first showed up to the stage in Kathmandu, the crowd barrier was about 100 feet away from the stage. And we were like, what is going on? Why is it so far away, man? You know, it feels like the people are really, really far away. And they basically said, if they don't dig you guys, they're just going to start throwing shit at you. And we're like, oh, okay. Well, you know, we're somewhat used to getting stuff thrown at us in the past. So we ended up negotiating for the barrier to be 50 feet closer. So they were only 50 feet away from us. So, yeah. you know, I mean, if they were going to throw something, it would make it easier for them. But
also enough, you still have enough time to duck, maybe.
Yes, exactly. So it ended up being really, really cool. And all those trips ended up being one of those things where it was an amazing litmus test as an artist and as a musician to be able to go to places and present our music without anything and have people react to it in such a positive way, you know, and just dig on the music and dance, you know? So in Kathmandu, we ended up pulling like 10,000 people. In Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, I think it was estimated 15 to 20,000 people at the show. And all these different places, we just had really, really cool shows and really, really was able to not only share our music with all the people, but also come back home with all the local music that of all the different places we come to marinate, to study, and to like maybe possibly influence us, you know?
Very cool, man. How old were you at the time when you were involved with that?
I was probably in my 30s. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Still very cool.
Yeah.
So we're going to go out with another track off of Fire Away. Another one that we've been spending the last several weeks here in the Underground Garage. Not a for free. Mm-hmm. And I feel this kind of Louie vibe to it. There was the El Loco Cha-Cha kind of thing.
Yes. I mean, those are the chords. Dun, dun, dun.
Well, what do you recall about the songs Gestation and Birth?
That one was just a super fun song. And, you know, it's just this, obviously Justin's rapping this character. this big knucklehead. And, you know, he's just kind of, you know, each verse is kind of this experience of what he's talking about. And, he, it was just super fun to do that song. And yeah, you're totally right. You know, it's kind of has that kind of like that feel to it. But then obviously with the rap and all the other things, it's a little different too, you know?
Right. You also modeled it.
Yeah, Ozomali did.
Yeah. Well, Uli, thank you so much for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Thank you so much. And thank you guys for playing the record. Thank Little Steven for digging on it. It was a huge surprise that he was into this record and playing it. And you guys have been supporting it. And maybe check out the new record. Maybe there's a couple tunes on there that you guys dig too. But all around, nothing but love and appreciation. Thank you.
All right. Well, let's check out this track off the album Fire Away, Not a Spore Free. It's Ozomatli and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Check it out, y'all. So check my status, aka Senior Badass, the heavyweight in town, metal, conganas. I'm Mr. Get Whatever, whenever, however. If you be up in my way, chinga dasos forever. I run up on the squinkly, cough up your catetta. He's shaking in his chonies, reaching for his fedia out the corner of my distracted by some nalgas. This little pinchy liver kicks me right in the pelotas.
That was Ozomatli here in Little Steven's Underground Garage with some of the song Not Us For Free. That's off their 2010 album, Fire Away. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to member Uli Bea for speaking with me today. And thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. My band, The Woggles, have a new single out this week on Wicked Cool Records, Flesh Hammer, a tribute song to our late friend and bandmate Jeff Walls. The song was engineered and co-produced with Dave Klein. Now, he's worked with all sorts of garage and punk bands and played in some notable ones as well, including The Seeds and Agent Orange. We'll talk about Flesh Hammer, Dave's work with other bands, and his career in general. That's next time around on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.